Readers, writers, listeners, welcome. This is the Page Turners Podcast, and I am your host, Miranda, an avid reader, a published author, and a longtime listener of podcasts. This is the Page Turners Podcast, Season 2, Episode 8. Happy Thanksgiving, listeners! Oh my gosh, I am so incredibly thankful for you, for this digital space that we have, and of course, for everyone sharing the importance of literacy. There is truly so much to be thankful for this year. I'm just taking a moment to just revel in it, to say thank you for being here. Of course, I've already said that, but also just the endless opportunities that this year has brought. You know, being Miss South Dakota and everything that that entails, getting to compete for Miss America, the conversations that I've had here for the Page Turners podcast, I just, yeah, taking a second to really revel in it and just be grateful. Well, today's episode could not land on a more perfect day, to be honest. It's as if I planned it. I had the chance to sit down with an incredible storyteller and playwright behind the Broadway play, The Thanksgiving Play. And of course, we discuss it and how it shines a light on representation, both on and off the stage, as well as the impact of literacy on her life. So our Thanksgiving guest is, drumroll please, Larissa Fasthorse.
Yeah, hi. My name is Larissa Fasthorse. My name is Larissa Fasthorse. I'm a playwright and theater maker and writer in other forms as well, but theater is my main form that I work in. And I'm from South Dakota.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about yourself, like just a little bit more. Give me some background about where you grew up, how it is that you got into the career that you have today. Talk a little bit more about that for me.
Sure. Yeah. So I grew up in South Dakota. My enrollment is over on the Sechanga Lakota Nation, but I grew up mostly in winter until I think through kindergarten. And then my dad worked for the state. So we moved up to Pierre. And that's where I stayed through high school and graduated from Riggs. I was actually a professional ballet dancer first. I studied with at the Forney Cronin Studio in Pierre, South Dakota. And I did that for my first 10 years professionally. And then, like, you know, many folks, you know, you're 30 and you're old and retired in ballet. That's actually a long career in ballet. And so I was really fortunate that at that time I was living in Los Angeles, where my husband is from, and I found an organization called Career Transitions for Dancers. And they help dancers, because we're so young when we retire, transition to other careers. And so through a long series of what are they called, like a career counselor that they gave me, I was able to find writing in script form. That was written just on my own. My family and I, you know, our perfect vacation would be to go to the Black Hills, stay at a cabin in the Southern Black Hills, and read and write all day out in nature. You know, that's what we do.
Doesn't that just wonderful?
Yeah, it's perfect, right? So that's what we'd take a book and we'd climb a rock and take a book and a notebook and just read and write. So I'm really fortunate that that was so much part of my life growing up. My mom was a librarian, my dad's a sociologist and criminologist. And so the transition to writing just made sense, and transition to script writing made sense because I was in Los Angeles. So I worked in film and TV first, and I was really frustrated at the time. It was about 15 years ago, and being a Native American woman in Los Angeles then, trying to work in film and television was just really hard. Representation of Native women was not good, and the watering down of Indigenous culture was pretty severe. And so I realized quickly that was not going to be the beautiful career I just had in ballet. And I was fortunate that I had a script I was working on at Sundance, and I was commissioned by Peter Brocious at Children's Theater Company of Minneapolis to write my first play. And I've told people many times, I was like, oh, this is Dancers with Furniture. I'm home and I can do this. And I became a playwright, and I really, you know, just did that exclusively for about 12 years. And then just before COVID, I ended up going back to film and television. So now I do both. I do all three, actually. I'm developing theater projects, film projects, and TV projects.
That is incredible. And I love that you describe playwriting as, you said dancers with furniture,
furniture. Yeah.
right? that made me giggle. 'Cause it's, I think that's a great representation or an accurate representation of probably that transition from you being a dancer to then moving into being a playwright. You mentioned that your mom was a librarian. Talk a little bit more about what that was like growing up with your mom being a librarian and maybe how that sort of influenced your future into what you're doing today.
Yeah. So she didn't actually start. She was a librarian at our high school at Riggs, and she didn't start until I was in late grade school. But before that, I mean, my family, we're all just avid readers. Like I said, you know, we'd read on vacation, we'd read all the time. On Sundays after church, we'd go to the library and pier and just hang out there for several hours.
Love
just
that.
Hanging in the library, you know. You know, I had an adult library card since I was like six, you know. So we read all the time. My family, that's something we did. And then we considered two things we considered like group activities that we did together was reading and walking. We'd walk everywhere. And so those are two things that have really stayed with me. You know, doing that much reading, doing that much comfort around words, you know, having that much comfort around words is absolutely crucial to what I do now. Although I will say the difference in, say, being a novelist or, you know, a fiction or nonfiction writer to what I do, writing script format, and this is something I tell kids all the time. You know, I do a lot of writing workshops on the reservations in South Dakota and Arizona and California and, oh my gosh, everywhere, so many places. I shouldn't start naming them all, but a lot of places. But one of the things I always tell them, the beautiful thing about script writing is you can't do it wrong. It's just people talking. So if you can talk, you can write, and there's no, you don't have to worry as much about like the rules of grammar and spelling. You just have to like be able to think in words and put, and then we can help you put them down. And so that's why I really love script writing. Is something that we use as a literacy tool with a lot of folks who unfortunately are going to school systems that are not particularly strong in literacy. But you don't have to know the rules of anything to be able to write a script. You just need to know how to talk. And talk, and then have someone say something back, and then you say something. So that's that easy, you know. And so we really, it's fun to see now, you know, being able to take these tools that I had, but then to see kids who, you know, will go in, they'll say, oh, they're not going to write anything. They'll never write. They hate writing, blah blah. And I've not yet had a kid in, you know, knock on wood here, 15 years of doing this, not write something. And not write some kind of script. Sometimes we scribe for them, but they always, you know, it's their words that we're just writing down for them.
And I think that's super approachable. And, you know, representation is one of the key pillars of my literacy initiative. And I love that you're showing these kids, especially, that they can still be a storyteller. They can write, they can become an author, they can use their stories or whatever inspires them. And maybe they can't physically put it on a page, but you can help them make that happen. And hopefully that kind of inspires, you know, that continued want to share your story and to read story. And I think that's incredible. Mm-hmm. I want to know, though, when you were growing up, you know, clearly you had this incredible foundation in literacy and parents who loved to make sure that reading was an important piece of your childhood. Mm-hmm. Did you ever think that you would become a, you know, an author, a storyteller, a writer? Was that something that you envisioned for your life?
Not at all. No. I mean, since I was in fifth grade was when I made I started ballet, hilariously, what's called late in my world, you know, in second grade. That's really late for a ballet dancer. But in fifth grade is when I made the decision that I was going to be a dancer. And though that was thanks to a book. So an aunt of mine had given me a book of like, you know, inspirational women, you know, it'd be like the Rebel Girls books, but whatever it was back in my childhood. And one of them was Maria Tolchi. And, you know, and I saw it and I was like, oh, okay. You know, mixed race, native chick in the middle of nowhere became a professional ballet dancer. And that just seeing her in that book, I can still see the page so clearly in my mind, said to me, oh, okay, that's a real thing. And from then on, I decided I was going to be a dancer. And I did, you know, like, which was crazy. I'd never even seen a ballet. My parents had never seen a ballet. Like, we didn't know anything about it. But, you know, just being able to have that become real on the page and printed and written and set, you know, all these people thought that this was a legitimate thing for that book to get to me, you know, that my aunt had bought somewhere and sent to me, and somewhere in the Twin Cities and sent to me. You know, that reality of paper, there's something really powerful, magical about that. And so that definitely affected my life, but it certainly wasn't, you know, with a thought that I'd ever write myself. I mean, I always just wrote things, but never formally in any way.
So you mentioned, you know, seeing her within that book and seeing this Native woman, this mixed race woman from nowhere becoming a ballerina was very impactful for you. How has that continued to maybe shape what you do as a storyteller and as a script writer? Because you focus heavily on representation, especially in some of your, you know, more recent pieces, if not all of them.
Yeah, I'd say all of my work, yeah, definitely focuses on representation, different kinds, both as a woman and as a Native woman, you know, both of those very specifically. It affected everything. You know, just the knowing how powerful, like just seeing something like that can be, knowing, I will say that, you know, the beautiful thing, even though I work in theater, which is, you know, an immediate format, you know, my plays, most of them are published. And so I hear from people, they're like, they've picked up suddenly a play that I wrote 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And for them, it's the first time. And so there is something really magical about that written, printed word, that's so lovely that people can be affected by it and have an experience with it. And I was like, wow, to me, that, like, I have to remember it because it was so long ago, you know, but to them, it's right now. And that's what's so beautiful about that. That means a lot to me. And so when I'm creating work, I'm always thinking about that. I'm thinking about that. Honestly, I would say I'm writing for like a half Lakota woman, girl in South Dakota. Like, no matter, even if it's an adult piece, whatever it is, I'm always thinking about that girl. Like, what is it that she needs to see? How are these images going to affect her? Which of these images are going to empower her? Which of these images are going to let her know that there's, you know, there's such a huge world out there, and she has so many choices, including staying right where she is, you know, mm-hmm. and that all of those choices are beautiful. I mean, I would love to live in South Dakota the rest of my life. Unfortunately, just my job doesn't live there, you know, and I wish it did, you know. I was just there all summer working on the play that we just toured around the state, and, you know, just letting people know that these choices are there. There's so many choices and so many options. Sometimes, you know, even with the internet, you know, still growing up in somewhere like South Dakota, which I grew up before the internet, but even now, you know, it can feel small, and it can be hard to know that how many choices are available to you, and how even staying home can be different than what you thought it would be. And so I really think about that girl all the time when I'm writing, and how can I represent her and encourage her.
I think that's incredibly admirable, you know, for you to think in that way, to think about almost, and maybe I'm wrong here, correct me if I am, but it's almost like you're thinking of you when you were, sure. you know, that young girl living in South Dakota, and, you know, kind of figuring out that the world was open to you. And I think that's incredible that you think about that when you write your pieces, because I can imagine there are some people that don't, you know, you just kind of put words to paper and they just put it out there. But to think in that sort of grander scale, I think is something that everybody needs to do. I think everybody yeah. can kind of reframe their brain to think about the impact that their words can have mm-hmm. and the importance, especially, of having that representation. So I just think that's incredible that yeah. you have that in the back of your brain when you are writing. I think that's incredible.
Oh yeah, always. And actually, I'm a Rebel Girl, because I was just asked by the folks that did the Rebel Girl books to write something and for their newest book that just came out called Dear Rebel. And what I wrote to was myself. Like, I just wrote to young me, you know, and talked to her about, you know, what it looks like now and what's to come. And, you know, because I'm always writing to that girl. Yeah.
So talk with me a little bit about the representation in your plays. Mm-hmm. This is our Thanksgiving episode, so of course I want to hit on the Thanksgiving play, but I just love to kind of talk overall about, you know, the things that you write mm-hmm. and how representation truly plays a role within those actual plays and those scripts.
Yeah, you know, the Thanksgiving play came out of frustration of representation. It was, about 12 years into my career as a playwright, and things were going well, and I had a lot of commissions, and things were being produced, and it was great, but I wasn't getting subsequent productions. So like what happens in theater, a theater will commission you, meaning they give you a certain amount of kind of advance money, basically, to write a play, and they develop it, and they may produce it, they may not. I was fortunate that a lot of people were producing it, and then you get paid royalties based on ticket sales, and then that's it, right? Except maybe, gets published scripts, but honestly, that's not very much, that's not money you can live on. And so selling the scripts later. And so where you make your money as a playwright is in subsequent productions, other theaters picking up the piece, and it continues to make money for you.
Okay.
That wasn't happening to me. My plays were getting produced by that one theater that already put money into it, and then no one else was stepping up. And so I was like, this is, I've been doing this a while, and nothing, it's not happening. And so my agent and I started reaching out and asking people, like, what's up? And the number one reason I got was casting. Theaters kept saying, your plays are uncastable. And that was to one play, and what that meant was two plays have Native American characters in them. And one of my plays actually had one half Native American character in a theater company in Arizona, which has 23 recognized tribes, told me my play was uncastable.
Really?
So I was like, okay, this is clearly not true. But that's the perception that the theater community had at that time. And so I was like, okay, fine. This is in like, what was it? It was right before a couple years for the pandemic, so 16, 17, and so I was like, okay, fine, American theater, this is how you feel, I'm gonna create for you a play that still deals with all the contemporary Indigenous issues that I think are important, that people need to understand, as what contemporary that's what theater does, right? It helps us have empathy and understanding for others. So I wanted others to understand what contemporary Indigenous people are going through, and so I said, I'm going to take all those concepts, but I'm going to wrap them in a package of four white presenting people in one set. And so I was like, if you can't produce that in American theater, we clearly have another conversation to have. And, I would say it was my, it is my, most depressing success in some ways, because it did so well. But the good news about it is like, yes, that's what worked. Having four white presenting people is what changed everything for my career and my financial situation. But it's also a play that I love and I believe in and I stand behind. And it keeps getting updated, where the Broadway version is about, the new script for the Broadway version is about to come out, where we updated to new things are happening today. Yeah, thank you. And so, yeah, I'm excited. So I just proved the second galley. So, I'm happy with the play and I love the play and it does so many great things. And then ultimately the best part that happened was that meant that now this year, we had a few years off during the pandemic and I was dealing with, my father had long COVID, so I was doing caretaking and stuff. But now that I'm back in the theater world and production, I had 7 plays this year and all of them were majority, not quite all of them, 6 of them were majority Native characters.
That's incredible.
And then the 7th one that I'm doing right now, Peter Pan, has 2 Indigenous characters and 4 Indigenous performers in it and an Indigenous fight choreographer and so it's really I had to write the play that had non-Native people first, but now that's giving me the ability to hire so many Indigenous artists and have them do all these roles I've been dreaming of for them for so long. So that's really exciting that it worked. and the Thanksgiving play has such a huge reach. I only have positive gratitude, for the reach. It's once again on the top 10 most produced plays list. It's kept me on the top 20 most produced playwrights list. So I'm really fortunate that it's still, people still want to hear it and it's out there. And I actually hear people that like now they write to me and they're like, they sit around the Thanksgiving table and they read it together as a family. It's like, oh, that's wild. Yeah. I was like, that, you guys have a really cool family. people do a lot of interesting things with it now at Thanksgiving. It's kind of becoming part of their family tradition, which is wild and awesome and makes me really happy because it is making them think about their places, white folks, the issues around Thanksgiving, Native folks, and all those things. So a lot of people are being represented in interesting ways in that play, and it's certainly had an impact.
I think I have a two-part question listening to that. Mm-hmm. So of course, you know, one of the big pieces is talking about the importance of that other story, if you will, kind of the other story of Thanksgiving. So I'd love if you could talk to the importance of sharing that, but also, you know, what was it like for you to see that that representation could have happened? It could have happened sooner, you know, how, especially, you know, we're specifically talking Indigenous, you know, characters and Indigenous cast currently, you know, it could have happened before, but it sort of had to wait until you kind of break through that barrier. What was it like having to do that and knowing it's right there, we can do it, it's just not happening? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it was frustrating because, I mean, I knew all the actors were there. I was working with them, workshopping with them, and they're all over the country. Mary Catherine Nagle was doing better than I was at getting her plays produced with Native casts. I don't know why. I just couldn't seem to break through with it. I will say, you know, it's interesting because I still struggle with the fact that I'm a comedy writer. And, you know, folks still, you'll see if you look at my plays, they always say, like, on the title page, it says what it is, and it says, like, a satirical comedy, a satirical farce, you know, a comedy and with music, because people constantly are like, do I laugh? Is that okay? Because they still want like Native stuff to be serious. Even after Res Dogs, even after some, you know, Rutherford Falls, people want Native American content to be serious and they think it has to be serious. And that's not what I do at all. So I don't know if that's part of it too, that people are like, oh, well, Native people can't be funny. We can't cast Native, funny Native people. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, but because Mary Catherine does drama. So maybe she, I don't know. I should ask her, like, how'd she do this? But anyway, it's working now. So that's great. So, but I knew those actors were there and I knew that they were out there and I was doing workshops with them and doing, you know, readings with them and developing things with them and just never, you know, getting it past that. So yeah, it's been really exciting and to see it now and to see that, you know, also, I'm getting to work with actors now that I worked with way back at the beginning of my career. I'm here at doing Peter Pan with Ray Zaragoza, who's playing Tiger Lily. And I worked with her when she was 16 years old, wow, doing a musical for me, you know, and now she's a grown woman that's been out in the world as a famous folk singer. I'm working with Kenny Ramos, who I've been working with for 10 years, and we're on like our fifth or sixth play together. I just got to do for the people, the Guthrie in Minneapolis. I got to work with Kalani Kwepo, who I also worked with Ray when she was he played Ray's dad when she was 16 all these years ago. It was like my third play, you know. So, and George Keller, who was in my very first play at Children's Theatre Company, was an understudy in that. So it's just been really fun to see because these actors have been here all this time and they have decades of experience and they're really talented. They just, you know, yeah, I just really struggled to get theaters to approve them and to be willing to put them on their stages. But thank goodness it's finally happening now.
Yes, absolutely. So I gave you two really big concepts in one question. Sorry. So the other part was, you know, what is the importance of us focusing on, you know, the other story that comes with the Thanksgiving play? Because like I said, this is the Thanksgiving episode. And so I kind of want to hit on that. You know, what is that other story? And I say other because for a lot of people who will celebrate Thanksgiving, they may not know it, or maybe they didn't know it before they heard of your play. So if we could talk about that, I think that would be really impactful for maybe those listeners that don't know that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I actually, you know, growing up in South Dakota, I grew up in a time that was called the Era of Reconciliation with Governor George Nicholson, and unfortunately passed away in office. And we were not doing like Pilgrim and Indian Thanksgiving growing up. We were doing harvest and that sort of thing in public school then. It's interesting to see things change. But so, you know, now when I decided to write this play about Thanksgiving, I was really just looking for what's a holiday everyone thinks they know. And let me, you know, that also relates to Native people in some way. And I just knew it did. But I'll be honest, I didn't know that much about the history of Thanksgiving because I don't know, although we enjoy Thanksgiving and we celebrated it, it wasn't something like I said, we never did it in school. Mm-hmm. We always talked about harvest and fall. And so I had to do research myself and learn. And Point being, yeah, you can all just go ahead and learn. You can look it up. You can find things. Yeah, do some reading.
Never stop learning.
Yeah, there's stuff out there. And so, you know, as I was learning about it, it was really fascinating to go through. There's so many layers of history behind Thanksgiving. The holiday was actually created as a national holiday after the Civil War as a way of trying to reunite the North and the South, reunite the country in something that was non-specifically religious and something that was almost generic, which was gratitude. So we can all be grateful. So it wasn't even a thing until after the Civil War. And so it was created for a very specific political purpose. And I think that's something we always need to be interrogating when we hear any history, and for sure Thanksgiving is a very specific one. I was like, what was the purpose of putting the narrative out this way? So this narrative of this mythological dinner and all the things that happened were created for a reason, for a political reason, to try to knit the country together in something that no one could argue. We can all be happy about being grateful, and it's not, and it's about Native people, and you know, it has nothing to do with slavery. It has nothing to do with the North and the South, you know, all of that. So it's really interesting that, you know, when you start looking into when things happened and why, then you start to say, oh, I see, that's why this narrative has been created in this direction. Certainly there were people, there were Wampanoag folk who met, you know, the folks that we now call pilgrims at the time were called separatists. You know, and certainly there were people fleeing religious persecution that the separatists were, and certainly, you know, all these different things happened, and I guarantee you they ate together several times. They're humans occupying the same space. And times, you know, were hard in the winters, as we all know, growing up in South Dakota. So, you know, all that is like true, but the actual like idea of that one meal was very much created later, and then even the concept of something like that before it became a national holiday didn't come up until in writing until decades after it supposedly happened. So again, there was, if you go into the history of it, there's purpose why we suddenly needed a narrative of gentle, nice natives, and why we suddenly need a narrative of grateful pilgrims, separatists, but pilgrims now we call them, you know, all these things. So if you go back and start going through the layers, you can see the reality is there were, you know, the, if you look at the different, also as I did my research, there's so many different possible first Thanksgivings that happened in history and different folks that claim it. So like there's one claim in Florida, St. Augustine, Florida claims that they were the site of the first Thanksgiving. There's in El Paso, Texas, they claim they're the very first Thanksgiving. And then there's several places on the East Coast that claim to be the first Thanksgiving. And unfortunately, as we've discussed in the play, one of them is really gruesome. It was a celebration of victory over a massive, the Pequot Massacre, for massacring a lot of Native families. And so, and then they came home to celebrate with horrific games and feasting. And so there's all these different versions of what different folks that claim they're the first Thanksgiving. And so when you start going through like all those different ideas, you know, it just, I found it fascinating and kind of horrifying, you know, that we've then boiled it down to these little children's plays and songs and things that I use in the show. That like the first song, the 12 Days of Thanksgiving, seems innocuous. You know, it's the 12 Days of Christmas, but it's about Thanksgiving. But then when you look at it closely, it's about pilgrims being white people taking everything the land had, and the Indians were giving it to them, which at first, again, we're like, well, generosity is nice, sharing's nice, but it doesn't go both ways. And what it's teaching children is that all these other people are here to serve you, and that you should feel good taking everything from everyone. And the Indians should give you everything they have, including their homes, their shoes, their clothes, you know, everything, their weapons, their food, all of it in the song is given to the pilgrims. And they're happy about it. And the Indians are happy to give away everything they have. And so, you know, you start to look at that and like, wow, what are we teaching children? At like, this is meant for preschoolers. And we're teaching them at a very early age that, you know, the white children should receive all things and the brown children should give all things. you know, and so you have to start breaking down those things and say, yeah, on one hand, you could say it's just a song, but on the other hand, what is it? What's the message behind it? And why is that message there? And then start going through history to figure it out.
With you, so remind me, how long have you been a playwright? Did you say 12 years, or it's been longer than that?
15 years.
15 years. Yes.
15-ish. It might be 16 now. So time is just going. It's been a very long. I've had 7 shows this year. It's a crazy year. This is just kind of the longest year.
I appreciate you having time for this.
Yeah, it's fine.
So 15, 16-ish years, yeah. You know, within this world, and you've seen a lot of change, even just with what you're able to produce and the people that you're able to cast. Yeah. What do you think is the future of improving representation? How do we ensure that in literature, in popular media, in whatever it may be, that we are focusing on representation?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean,
that's a big question.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I hope the future is good. but you know, honestly, it still takes intentionality, right? Right now I'm here, like I said, I'm working on Peter Pan, and the director, who happens to be a white man, and myself, we were very intentional that this had to be a cast that represents America. We wanted, to us, it was important that this story, if we're going to redo this story, we have to redo it for children today. And that children, our goal was that any child from any economic background, from any racial background, could look out their window and believe that Peter was going to fly by. And that hasn't been the case before this, right? The original Peter Pan, it's very problematic. It's got a lot of issues. And so, you know, I've read all the versions of the book from the book forward. And so that being said, what that meant was we had to go into casting with intentionality so that the broadest range of children, when they come to the show, will see themselves on stage. And have that experience I had with Maria Tolci, seeing her in that book, right? Where you see yourself like, oh, look, that's a thing. I deserve to be up there. I deserve to have, you know, we're playing the biggest houses around the country, you know, that I deserve to have 3,000 to 6,000 people watching and cheering for me and doing my job excellently with this incredible production, you know, that's what I deserve, no matter where I'm from. And so when we went into casting, it did take, I will say, a little extra effort, because we had to keep saying, wait, where is everybody? We need to be sure we have this really broad spectrum. We haven't hit everybody yet, but we've got a really, really broad spectrum of folks. But we had to constantly say, wait, how, and people will call this quotas. And that wasn't it. It wasn't a quota, like we have to have one Black person and one. It was, does this cast yet look like the America it's going to be traveling to? It's a national tour. Does it look like, you know, every neighborhood in Chicago? Does it look like every neighborhoods in South Dakota? Does it look like neighborhoods in, you know, I hope we get to one day, but does it look like neighborhoods in, you know, Florida, in California, in Arizona? Like, does it look like all of those children that hopefully also, you know, we have to remember we're going to be coming with school groups, right? So we'll have a really broad spectrum of kids coming. Are they all going to see themselves? And so it took that kind of constant intentionality and constantly saying, wait, hold it. These children aren't going to see themselves. We want them to see themselves. Mm-hmm. And then looking for someone to fill that space, to fill that representation. So like I said, some people will call it quotas, or, you know, people talk about the Rooney Rule and all these goofy things. For us, it was just like thinking about the children. And making sure that they see themselves and they feel represented. And that just guided everything. But it takes a constant interrogation and constant intentionality behind it. I think we're getting better at representation, at broader representation. But I would say I still see a lot of people coming at it with the idea of checking boxes. Mm-hmm. As opposed to thinking about your audience, you know, so we were thinking about these little people and wanting them to see themselves and wanting them to have that confidence in that in themselves, because I could be up there and I deserve to be up there. as opposed to saying, oh, we have to check off one of these, and that makes people othered and weird and creepy. And so I think, you know, we now need to wrap our brain around the intentionality. Why do we want to do these things, and make sure you're doing it from a good place with a good heart that is sincere. And once you do that, you'll end up with what we ended up with, this incredibly beautiful, diverse group of people that look like, you know, I'd say 90% of our country is represented in this cast, which is kind of incredible.
That is truly incredible, especially in a day and age where we think a lot more about mm-hmm. diversity and equity and inclusion, but it's still missing. It is still missing from so mm-hmm. many areas of life. And mm-hmm. to use a play, a children's story, if you will, as kind of a way to bring that to the forefront of people's mm-hmm. minds, that is incredible.
Yeah. So, and we're also, I mean, I will say too, also people say, well, it's so hard. And it's like, well, you know, is that the reason not to do something? Because it wasn't hard. It actually wasn't hard, but it, like I said, but it took intention. Mm-hmm. And there's a difference between something being hard and maybe a little effort, you know, and that's what we found. It was just a little bit of effort. It wasn't actually hard. And there are things that are hard in life. This was not hard. And we're in this incredibly beautiful, privileged position to be able to hire lots of people. So why wouldn't we put a little bit of effort into representing this broad range of people? And I think if everyone thought of it as like, oh, I could put a little effort into mm-hmm. creating this sort of change, as opposed to things being hard or whatever, or why do I have to, or whatever. It's like, yeah, it's a little effort. That's not much to ask.
I think that's a great way to kind of frame it in your mind. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we have talked about the Thanksgiving play. We've now talked about Peter Pan that you are literally taking a break from in this
yes. yeah.
this conversation. What are some of the other things that you're currently working on that people can kind of keep an eye out for from you?
Yeah. You know, I'm doing so many things right now. You know, the next thing, I think Thanksgiving play is still playing like just all over the country, which is great, and I'm thrilled. The next one I'm going to be a part of is the one at Steppenwolf Theater Company in Chicago this spring that Jess McLeod is directing. I'm really excited about that one because they're putting it in their In the Round space, and I've never seen a show done in the round. So I'm really excited, just thrilled they've invited me to come and be a part of this production, even though I've done lots of them, just to see, you know, how it translates into that sort of space. It's one of my favorite kinds of spaces, so I'm thrilled about that. We're also, you know, looking at continuing and fundraising to continue our work in South and North Dakota, and we did our show Wichu last year, and we've actually got a good amount of unannounced money, you know, seed grant to continue, you know, exploring and fundraising to tour that show again to more places in South Dakota. That's a show created by, with, and for Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota people. And so we're really thrilled to be able to keep that going. I don't know if we won't be able to do a full production this coming summer, but we're doing all the groundwork to do it then the next year and do another full production. Based all our learnings from the last time we did reservation tours are a complicated beast, but it was great. 3 weeks, we drove over 4,000 miles. And then we did lots of workshops. We do a lot of workshops with not just youth, but youth is one we're most often asked to do, but we do them with anybody. These workshops involve people always writing their own work. So writing their work and then reading it in some way, in a performative way. And then I'm working on a new play at the Public Theater here in New York City, where I am right now. I have a new play that I've been working on, Center Theater Group and Arena Stage, that's going to most likely be next season. I have a play at Yale Rep, at Seattle Rep, and then developing some commercial projects. And then I've got a bunch of film and TV things that just like are just starting to come back. So we just got over the strike. So I can't say which ones they are yet, but we have a lot of things in the works, including a new animated movie with DreamWorks, which I'm excited about. Oh my gosh,
that's exciting. I've just got to know, what is it like to see your work literally taking place all across the country? That's got to feel pretty incredible.
It is incredible. I mean, you know, this is what I'd hoped for. It's also weird though, yeah, for sure. And I will say it's interesting because being a writer, so it's fascinating to me how much people, they think they know me, you know, like people will be talking to me like, oh, hi, we haven't met, blah, 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 and they go on and on. I'm like, oh, I mean, they've seen my interviews or read my work and they feel like we know each other, but we don't. It's always interesting.
They may feel really, like they know you, but you don't know them.
Yeah, I have no idea who you are, but you're great. but you know, it's lovely and it's sweet and I enjoy it, but it's an interesting phenomenon now because so much of my work is living out in the world without me. You know, because before the success of this, right, I was always there with each mm-hmm. piece that happened. Now there's so much of my work happening everywhere that I'm not there. That's really interesting to meet people that feel like they have a real connection to me through my work. And then like I said, it's lovely and I appreciate it, but so I'm still something I'm getting used to. I also have here when I did the Thanksgiving play on Broadway, there's this fantastic group of fans, of Darcy Carden, who, called the Peaches, who came to dozens of the show dozens of times, and they very much kindly adopted me and were very sweet. And now like I'm still in contact with a lot of them, you know, so it's really, yeah, it's very different. Have my work out in the world in this way. I get to meet so many beautiful people from all over the world actually, which is cool.
That's incredible. I ask every person that I bring onto this podcast, whether they're a traditional author or on mm-hmm. reading journey, or maybe kind of that non-traditional author storyteller. So I've got to know, what is your favorite book?
Oh, it's you know, it comes to mind right away. The Last Unicorn by mm-hmm. Peter S. Beagle. You know, and it's funny because it's a childhood book, but it's something I've read so many times in my life, and have had different, you know, it's a kid's book, but it's something that's just had meaning to me for such a long time. It was given to me by one of my aunts, whom I love very much. She gave me her own copy. It was a used copy that she'd read so many times. Mm-hmm. And I loved it so much. It's terrible, but I can say it because he's gone now. But I met the author because I was trying to adapt part of it into a play. And we had breakfast together in California when he was visiting once. And I showed him that I had this tattered old copy, and he grabbed it and signed it. And I was like, oh, that was my aunt's book. I didn't really want it, but it was fine. It was very sweet. And I'm thrilled. He meant well. I'm glad he did. It was lovely. But because I actually brought a different copy. I wanted him to sign that wasn't my aunt's, because my aunt had written in that one and she's gone now. And I was like, oh. But that's all right. He was a very sweet, lovely man. Anyway, so that book was about magic and about imagination and about finding who you are and about there being infinite possibilities to who you are. And it is about illusion and about creating what you want and what you don't want in your life. And it's just, it meant a lot to me growing up. So I still have an incredibly special place in my heart for that book.
I always love when I ask people that question, and there are the handful of people that pick a kid's book, and mm-hmm. it's almost like everybody has this moment where they're like, oh, it's a kid's book, you know, don't judge me or whatever.
Yeah. Around it.
But I love that so much though, because, you know, mm-hmm. you had talked about at one point in time, your mom was a librarian. My grandma was my librarian growing up.
And
my
mom cool.
was a teacher. And so some of my favorite books are kids' books to this day. Mm-hmm. I'm 25 years old, but it's like you said, you know, those were impactful. They came from a place of love. They inspired, you know, even if it was magical or animals or whatever mm. it was. I that's happened a few times where people have said kids books and they're like, oh, you know, don't judge me for it. But everybody has their favorite book for a reason. So I applaud. Yeah.
No, thank you. I know, I'm like, it should be something, it feels like it should be something like serious and academic, but it's so, you know,
when people ask me, my favorite book is Twilight from the Twilight series.
Oh,
and
really?
I have some others that are kids books too. But it's the same thing where I'm like, it should probably be something, you know, a little bit more grand, yeah. like Moby Dick or, but it's not. So yeah, it is what it is.
There you go. Right. And clearly it worked out well for both of us. So
yes. Yes. As long as you find that book that kind of sparks a passion or whatever it may be. That's what I always tell people. It doesn't need to be anything grand or crazy, just something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. Is there anything else that you would like to leave us with? Any advice, anything like that, that you think maybe we missed or kind of can wrap things up?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the one thing I was most surprised, you know, when I was first asked to be a playwright, the first thing I said was, oh, I can't do that. I don't have a degree in anything. You know, I didn't go to college to learn to be a writer. I've never taken a writing class. And obviously I was wrong. but, you know, I think, you know, just being, knowing that there's and now that I've been doing it, I know there's 100 paths to being a writer, you know, and there's 100 ways that people become a writer, and people with formal education, without formal education, people, you know, whose mothers were librarians or grandmothers, or, you know, all the reasons and ways that people became a writer are so varied as the writers themselves. And so, you know, I think it's just about having, you know, a passion for something and having, I will be honest, the willingness to work really hard at it. You know, it's a lot of time. Being a writer is hard. It's months and months of time by yourself, just staring at a screen, you know, and you have to actually type every word. It's a thing. And so, you know, it's a lot harder work than people realize. But I also think it's not, people try to make it something a little exclusive, and it's not at all. Anybody can sit in and write a story. And I wish everyone would.
Once again, happy Thanksgiving, and thank you so much for joining us for the Page Turners podcast. Make sure that you keep an eye out for the next episode, and until then, leave a review, share with a friend, and check us out on social media at Miss America SD to keep up with all things literacy and falling in love with reading. Catch you next time.